scientists and atheists is reaching a fever pitch. Some seek to find common understanding and agreement. This is a place where we begin with differences and end with similarities. This is Apologia.
Hello and welcome to Apologia. My name is Zachary Moore and I'll be moderating and participating in the discussion today. As always, Apologia is a collection of theists and atheists who are here for a friendly roundtable discussion about our different perspectives and where we can find agreement. If you happen to have feedback for the discussion, you can give it at the website for this podcast, which is hosted at drzach.net. Today we have with us John Wilson, who is a student of philosophy and a seminarian at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And we also have Dan Sawyer, who is the author of Sculpting God, and whose work you can find at jdsawyer.net, and who is also the co-host of the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Gentlemen, welcome to the discussion.
Howdy. Good evening.
All right, well, today we're going to begin talking about the so-called Jesus myth hypothesis, which we've touched upon previously in the discussion. This is an historical hypothesis that is not new, although due to some recent publications has enjoyed something of a renaissance, especially among atheist circles online. Despite the fact that the recent documentary The God Who Wasn't There has popularized this hypothesis, or at least a subsection of it, it's still a decidedly minority view in the academy, however. So what we're going to be doing over the next several installments of Apologia is to lay out the collected evidences and arguments that together make up the mythicist hypothesis. This is not going to be a comprehensive collection or even an exhaustively detailed collection, but I hope at least it'll be a broad enough survey of the hypothesis to bring anyone who is unfamiliar with it up to speed. For those listeners that want to delve into the subject in more depth, I would recommend the work of Earl Doherty and Richard Carrier, as well as that of Robert Price. These three have been very active in this area recently. Bear in mind that those of us here in the Apologia discussion are not academic historians, so we're speaking solely as lay people in this area, but that's been the case throughout the podcast. So if you haven't minded so far, I guess there's no reason for it to be a problem now. In many ways, Christians are at a disadvantage when discussing this hypothesis with non-Christians, since their doctrinal foundation is that of Jesus being a real person who existed in real history, whereas many non-believers can also accept this position without also accepting the divine identity of Jesus as the Christ. The opposite situation can also be seen with discussions of the Shroud of Turin. There, it's the Christian who can take or leave the validity of the shroud as a legitimate relic, but non-Christians who more or less have to argue against its authenticity. Thus, for most non-Christians, the idea of mythical content in the story of Jesus is substantially less provocative. Most are aware of the unvoiced fourth option in C.S. Lewis's famous trilemma that, in addition to being either liar, lunatic, or lord, Jesus could have been legendary. This, on its face, shouldn't be a logical implausibility, since there are countless examples of similar characters throughout history who we can talk about with as much detail as the Gospels give us for the life of Jesus, but are universally recognized to be legendary characters. Santa Claus is the most obvious example, with a mythology of his own that may even eclipse what is understood about Jesus, as well as particular American characters that have been developed in recently modern history, such as Paul Bunyan, Pecos Bill, and Johnny Appleseed, to name but a few. But the fact that the fantastical stories about Jesus recounted in the Gospels and other non-canonical works are embellishments along the lines of the story of Paul Bunyan carving out the Grand Canyon isn't that controversial among historians, and even among Christians who are less devoted to literal interpretation of the Bible than some. What is interesting and somewhat revolutionary about the mythicist hypothesis is that when taken as a whole, it leads to the conclusion that although it's possible that there could have been a historical person at the foundational core of the early Christian movement, not only can we not conclude his existence through historical methodology, but it is most probable that nothing reported in the Bible tells us anything about such a person, not even that his name was Jesus. And so you should be able to see why the mythicist hypothesis is so obviously uncomfortable for most Orthodox Christians. It leads to the conclusion that there's actually more historical justification for a belief in Santa Claus than a belief in Jesus. Now, this is a radical conclusion indeed. And although I have been persuaded to this point, there is a great deal of distance one must cross to arrive there. Since it is such a long and difficult road, I've done my best to divide the evidences and arguments into three basic collections: arguments from silence, arguments from similarity, and arguments from biblical ahistoricity. It's important to remember that the mythicist hypothesis does not stand or fall on any particular collection of arguments, to say less of any individual argument found in any given collection. However, taken as a whole, the mythicist hypothesis is a kind of an argument to the best explanation, which is to say that when all the evidences and arguments are considered, it is more probable that the mythicist hypothesis is true than an historical alternative. So that being said, today we'll be looking at the arguments from silence. And from a historical perspective, an argument from silence is not an optimal kind of argument because it purports to prove a point not by submitting positive evidence, but by showing a lack of evidence. Usually the best that can be hoped from this kind of argumentation is agnosticism, unless one can also show that evidence of a certain kind would be expected given a particular claim. For example, simply pointing out that there is no physical evidence of the existence of large primates in North America is not enough to lead one to the conclusion that Sasquatches most probably do not exist. But one must also make the argument that if such primates did exist, we would expect to find such physical evidence. In that sense, the absence of evidence can be the evidence of absence, to contradict our former Secretary of Defense. And it is in this sense that we look at the letters of Paul, which are almost universally recognized as the earliest written record of Christianity, dating from about 50 to 60 in the Common Era, and are an historical glimpse of Christian teachings that are the closest to the time period in which Jesus is supposed to have lived. So, without further ado, the first main collection of arguments here is that Paul does not corroborate any of the narrative details about Jesus' life as described in any of the Gospels. Now, the way that the New Testament is laid out, you have the Gospels first and then the letters of Paul, and so it's easy to sort of forget, especially if you don't really know much about the formation of the canon, that the letters of Paul actually predate all the Gospels. That's a virtual certainty in terms of biblical scholarship, that the letters of Paul actually represent the earliest glimpse into the beginnings of Christianity.
It's worth pointing out at this point that even the most radically conservative Orthodox biblical scholars like Dan Wallace at Dallas Theological Seminary hold that the earliest Pauline letters predate Mark by at least 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. So it's pretty safe to say that when we're looking at Paul, we're looking at what the earliest Christians, or at least those who would have followed Paul, what they would have believed. The problem is that in the way that the canon is laid out, we have the Gospels first, and they have an incredible wealth of narrative detail. Mark is somewhat more sparse, but Matthew and Luke have a lot of really colorful things that they've placed in their Gospels. And so the tendency is to read the Gospels first and then look at the letters of Paul and sort of insert an understanding of these narrative details that we find in the Gospels into what Paul is talking about. However, a closer examination of the letters of Paul show that he really does not mention hardly anything about the historical details which are found in the Gospels. And in fact, the only narrative elements that Paul shares in common with the Gospels are the death, the burial, and the resurrection of a character named Christ. He doesn't even in 1 Corinthians 14, of course, you have – or 1 Corinthians 15, you have the the supposed tradition, the liturgy that's been handed down, although Price argues it's a later interpolation, but that's neither here nor there for this discussion, in which Paul says the tradition that he handed down to you, meaning the Corinthians that he's writing to, on the first place, the tradition which he had himself received was that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that on the third day he was raised to life in accordance with the Scriptures. And then he lists a number of appearances, of which he was the last one in the list. So in those three details, or not necessarily details, but those three narrative elements, Paul and the Gospels are together. But it's really only these three details. We don't hear anything about Jesus' birth, the fact that he was born in Bethlehem, the fact that he was from Nazareth. Any mention of his disciples explicitly. There are mentions of a person named Cephas, a person named Peter, who may or may not be the same people. There's mention of the 12, but none of these mentions are explicitly referred to as Jesus' disciples, and we sort of read back into the Gospels where we find people like Peter and we find a collection of 12 disciples that are explicitly mentioned, but Paul does not say anything about these people being Jesus' disciples. They're mentioned in the same breath with other apostles, but that is a fundamentally different sort of concept than disciple. There's also no mention of his healings or miracles. There's no mention of his parables or sayings, no quotations of any of these parables that are quoted very often in sermons in churches all over the country, all over the world on a weekly basis. But Paul never brought up a single one.
Not even when they would back up his point.
Right, and we'll get to that in the next collection. There are a number of very specific mentions that would have been advantageous. But other characters, other important characters in the Gospels, like the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, Joseph of Arimathea, none of these characters are mentioned at all. So right at the beginning, there seems to be some sort of a disconnect. If Paul really was aware of all of these details that are in the Gospel, he certainly does not seem to be communicating this to others. Interestingly, he does specify that the execution, the death of Jesus, that was by crucifixion. He mentions that in Galatians 3. He says, after you've had a clear picture of Jesus Christ crucified right in front of your eyes, who has put a spell on you. He's criticizing the Galatians at that point. So clearly he had a concept of Jesus being crucified, buried, and then being resurrected in some form. Although we'll return to that verse, I think, in a later podcast, because there's something a little bit more interesting there. The fact that he doesn't mention Jesus' miracles is kind of odd, given that one of the things that he taught was that the death of this person, Christ Jesus, had saved mankind from the demonic powers of the world. And as you mentioned, Dan, mentioning the fact that the historical Jesus who had existed and who had exercised power over the demons as he performed these miracles, you know, banishing demons from possessed people, exorcisms, those type of things, those would have been sort of natural for him to bring up. There's no mention of a man named Jesus of Nazareth. That's never found in Paul. And specifically, there's no equivocation of the name Christ Jesus with the concept of a man who had existed named Jesus of Nazareth, as he's referred to, you know, in the Gospels. By way of contrast, in the Acts of the Apostles, the book that was written by Luke in the second century, does explicitly refer to Christ as Jesus of Nazareth. It refers to Jesus Christ of Nazareth is actually the quote there in that book. So you find that a lot in the second century in the Acts of the Apostles, but you don't find that in Paul. Another thing that's kind of odd is that no defense is given for the blasphemous concept, at least the blasphemous to Jews that would have been contemporary to Paul, that a recently living man was God incarnate. This is, you know, something that for at least Orthodox Jews would have been kind of hard to handle. And so we would expect some sort of explanation of historical detail, you know, to back up this claim, and also for Gentiles, who also typically understood their gods in a mythical context and not, you know, in a recent historical context. Another thing that we find a lot in the Gospels is the reference of Jesus as the Son of Man. We find that that phrase a lot in the Gospels, derived ultimately from Daniel 7, I believe. Paul never mentions this term. If Paul has heard of the term Son of Man, well, certainly he had heard of that from Daniel, but if he'd heard of that in conjunction with Jesus, he never repeats that in any of his letters. It's somewhat odd that when he's defending his apostleship, he brings up the person of Cephas and the person of James, and he's sort of arguing that he's equivalent to these people. It also kind of seems odd that he would not mention the fact that they had been disciples of the earthly Jesus, that they had been with the person of Jesus when he was on earth, because that seems like an obvious sticking point and a point of contention between them. There's another aspect of the Gospels, the very famous point at which Jesus he basically renames Peter, and he says that you will be Peter the Rock, and on this rock I'll build my church. Again, Paul refers to Cephas, he refers to Peter quite often, never brings that up, although this was mentioned in obviously in the Gospels, but in some other late second century works, such as the Acts of Peter and the Twelve. Which is a weird little document where Peter and the other apostles travel to this metaphorical city called Habitation, and they meet Jesus in disguise, who recognizes him as Peter. And he brings up the fact that he gave him that name. Another thing that Paul does not mention from the Gospels is the baptism of either Jesus or John the Baptist, even though he talks about baptism quite a bit. In fact, in Romans 6, you know, he says, "So by our baptism into his death, we were buried with him, so that as Christ was raised from the dead by the Father's glorious power, we too should begin living a new life." So he's preaching baptism, he's teaching about baptism, but he never mentions that Jesus was baptized, and he never mentions anything about John the Baptist baptizing people or its redemptive properties. Paul seems to... One of the explanations for this may be that Paul claims to receive his authority from divine revelation, either through visions of Christ or through the Holy Spirit, and not from any apostolic succession or tradition. For example, in Galatians 1, he says that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man, for I neither received it from man nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. So this might be an explanation for that disconnect, why he doesn't seem to know about any of these details.
There's a further point there in that statement that lends another very small shred of evidence to the mythicist hypothesis, and that's that Acts, which obviously is attempting to be a history book, states quite clearly that Paul did receive his teaching from the 12.
Right.
We have Paul's own words saying that he never did.
Right. So, yeah. So under that argument, that portion of Acts was written to try to rein in Paul into the established hierarchy of the church that had been somewhat Jerusalem centered up to that point.
Or written later on as a way to reconcile the followers of Paul and of the Jerusalem church.
Right. Right. So it seems that Paul, for as much as he talks about a son of God, he believes in a son of God, but he doesn't really seem to be saying that anyone was the son of God, because there's really no historical connection back into a point of recent history. What are your thoughts, Dan?
You've summarized the arguments from Silence really well.
Okay.
Do you have the positive evidence from Philippians in your list there?
I don't. That I was actually going to save for the ahistoricity section.
Okay, should I leave that alone for now then?
You can bring it up, and we'll okay. touch on it later also.
Okay. There's a passage in Philippians that comes right out and says that Jesus was not the name of the Son of God when he was on earth. It's Philippians 2:5-11. It reads, "You should have the same attitude towards one another that Jesus Christ had." And then Paul quotes a hymn. He says, "Who, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking on the form of a slave, by looking like other men, and by sharing in human nature. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. As a result, God exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow in heaven and earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord."
Right.
This is widely regarded by both conservative and liberal biblical scholars as the single oldest hit piece of Christian writing that exists. And wow. it comes right out and says that the earliest church did not believe that Jesus was the name of the man they believed walked on the earth.
And I think some of the rejoinders to that involves saying, well, but the name that is to be the name that he got was Christ, right? But the problem with that is that Christ really isn't a name.
No, and Jesus and Christ are both words that mean Messiah.
Right. They're both
yeah, titles.
Right. They're both essentially titles. So John, what are your initial impressions of all this?
Well, it's in approaching a lot of stuff, it can be overwhelming. A lot of this is still pretty new to me. I've been listening to some podcasts, and you gave me some handy dandy books, and you know, I've looked at some stuff online, and at first it's quite a blow. I've talked to a couple of my friends about it actually who are believers, and I said, you know, this stuff's pretty heavy, and if you're going to look into this, be really careful with it, because as I had to learn, listen to all these podcasts and stuff, some days I just totally load up on nothing but podcasts about atheism and the mythicist position and all this stuff, and it's kind of like a self beat down, really, it's really kind of overwhelming, and it really it can feel pretty negative. And so I think a good caution for either side, even really, when studying anything like this, is to take things as they come and really think it through while you're listening and while you're reading, because, you know, depending on what kind of view you're going to take of Scripture, whether, you know, obviously if you want to read it totally literally, which is, in and of itself, that's kind of a difficult phrase, but, I guess how we generally think of people reading Scripture literally, there are obviously some pretty big problems. Mm-hmm. And you know, that it raises all kinds of other questions. I mean, this whole concept of the mythicist position, really affects a whole lot of stuff. It affects, all kinds of doctrines. And so, it's pretty weighty. It's pretty overwhelming. And, I think what Christians are going to have to do with it is take things as they come and see what can really be done.
Right.
Like I said, I've heard, I've listened to some Bob Price and, and some Richard Carrier, and some of these cats can get on a roll and they really start going, and they're just like, golly, how could this guy be wrong? Listen to him. You know, he's throwing out all kinds of facts, and, this history guy, I've never even heard of that dude. And, you know, and so it really seems, you know, hardcore, but some of the scripture quotations and things I've looked into, and I'm like, well, wait a minute, that's not quite as clear. And also sometimes some of the comparisons to other myths and stuff, it's not quite as neat and parallel, I think, as sometimes it's made out to be, and that could just be me. I could just be taken that a certain way. But I think for Christians who want to look into this and not feel like they're just going to get wiped out and they've got to give up their faith or something, I think there are two things to keep in mind. One is to wrestle with the text itself. And I know that I go to a Southern Baptist seminary and probably shouldn't say things like this, but we have got to be willing to let some things go. And I don't mean that in the sense like, well, we're defeated, let's pack up and forget the whole inerrancy thing. Because obviously, you know, I mean, I think we have to say, okay, what am I willing to have a loose grip on? If, you know, for whatever reason I look into it, I don't think scripture is as inerrant as I thought or whatever. Does that mean Jesus doesn't exist and God doesn't exist and he didn't die for my sins and all this and, you know, I'm not a Christian anymore and let's forget the whole thing? Well, no. And I don't think any Christian, when pressed, would really say that. But if you come at it from...
Unless you're talking about Kent Hovind, you know.
But I think coming at it the other way and saying, you know, are you willing to give up inerrancy? I mean, that's kind of the wrong... you have to ask questions a certain way, but the point of that is to take it piece by piece and say, okay, how much does this affect? What does it affect? And are there good arguments against this and that kind of thing?
Right.
And the second thing that I would caution would be something that Robert Price said. He made a very good point of this. And it was actually kind of convicting for me just because I was getting kind of nervous. Like I said, I was listening to a lot of this at once and it was just really overwhelming. And I was getting a little nervous, but obviously I see, you know, God working through Robert Price, which I think he would have a fun laugh at. But he said, if a Christian's going to read this stuff and get into it, and they start off thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to look into this and, you know, just kind of dismiss it, or, you know, I don't want to read too much because I don't want to go too far, because what if this disproves my faith? He said, what kind of faith do you really have? He's like, man, if you're thinking that way going into the game, you might as well give up now anyway.
Yeah.
If you go into it thinking there's a way out or a way that you're just going to get trashed here, then you're already kind of defeated in that sense. And so what I've had to do is to take it piece by piece, line by line, and say, okay, what does this really affect? And so I'm still looking into it.
Now, John, you've in your work in the seminary and with different ministries that you bumped into, you run into people who convert to Christianity because they're convinced of it. And I'm sure you've also run into people who convert to Christianity because they're on an emotional high, right?
Mm. Yeah.
When people are looking at material like this, like Jesus hypothesis or Jesus myth hypothesis and other similarly momentous ideas, it is very, very easy either to get caught up in the thrill of the puzzle or in the paranoia that you're going to have to give something up. And both of those emotions are very physiologically intoxicating. They cloud your judgment. It's easy to ride an emotional wave, get dumped somewhere that's very difficult to deal with, and in looking back, not know how you got there. And you wind up unmoored from everywhere, not really having a good place to go because you can't remember your own chain of reasoning. You can't feel confident in your decision, but you feel like a sellout going back to what you used to believe. And this, I've seen this happen both with religious conversions from unbelief and with deconversions from religious belief. Hmm. I think it's very important when investigating philosophical issues that have the potential to change your life, that you don't fall into the error of going too fast, thinking with your emotions, and over advocating the position you don't believe in. Just as important as it is, I think, to not fall into the apologetic trap of sectioning off connected pieces of evidence so that you can deal with them in such isolation that you can knock everything out from a case with intellectual dishonesty. I think that's very important, both for atheists looking at Christianity and for Christians looking at things like the Christ myth hypothesis.
Yeah. And specifically with the Christ myth hypothesis, I think that the best thing for it is this kind of thing, you know, bringing all the threads together and making some sort of a coherent understanding of the overall hypothesis, so it can be put out there and so it can be criticized and we can, yes, it can be sharpened up. And that's one of the things that has not happened yet. Although the Jesus Project may be sort of maybe tangentially, yeah, they might be heading in that direction. But what we need is, and I'm not volunteering myself necessarily for this, but something like what we're doing here, where we're taking all the threads of the arguments, putting them together and putting them on the table, because these need to be vetted, because everybody coming to the table is going to have their own biases. And it's only by getting people that are initially critical of the views to really point out the things that, you know, somebody like myself, somebody like Dan might not, you know, it might not be obvious to us. So mm-hmm. that's what we need. But moving on to the next section, so we can keep on going. And we touched on some of these before. The fact that Paul does not cite Jesus's teachings, even though it would be beneficial for his arguments if he had done so. And like I said, there's absolutely nothing about any historical details and any of the parables or any of the sayings that that Paul includes of Jesus that Paul includes in his letters. However, there are a lot of arguments that Paul makes, a lot of things that he has in his letters that it seems like, if you know, given the assumption that he would have known about these details about the historical Jesus, that these would have been obvious things to cite or to quote. And I'll just go through some of these right now. For example, once again, back in 1 Corinthians 15, after he goes through that old liturgy, he says, "Now, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you be saying that there is no resurrection of the dead?" And he goes in this long spiel about you know, why the resurrection of the dead is essential for the Christian faith. Why is it that Paul is arguing about, he's trying to convince people that the dead can be resurrected, but he does not mention the story of Lazarus? That seems like
The story of the zombies in Jerusalem,
or the stories of the zombies in Jerusalem, right, in Matthew 28. But you know, the story of Lazarus is one where, you know, Jesus is right there. You know, he goes, this guy's been dead 3 days. Jesus goes and you know, resurrects the guy. I mean, that's just a perfect case in point to say, well, look, how can you be doubting that the dead can be resurrected? Jesus himself, you know this, Jesus resurrected Lazarus when he was in his earthly sojourn. Also, when Paul talks about – this is kind of fuzzy. When Paul talks about the Christian Eucharist, he does in 1 Corinthians 11:23. He gives this account, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, in the night which he was betrayed, took bread, and blah, 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 do this in remembrance of me." Pretty much the same stuff that's in Mark 14. So, the only problem is he says that he received this from the Lord. In other words, he received this through direct revelation and not by learning about the historical Jesus from his disciples. There's another sort of explanation, possible explanation for this. Earlier in 1 Corinthians in chapter 10, he's making an argument about the Israelites receiving supernatural food and drink, based on, you know, the Jewish scriptures. And he also draws upon Leviticus 17. You know, the blood is the life. It's the blood that makes atonement. In chapter 5, when he refers to Christ as the Paschal Lamb, which has been sacrificed. So again, we're seeing something that was echoed in the Gospels, but Paul is claiming to have received that through direct revelation. And also he seems to be getting some of these from scriptural revelation, that is, you know, going through the scriptures and sort of reinterpreting or re-understanding what was already there.
Which is a Jewish tradition called Midrash.
Midrash,
and even,
right.
Even at that time, it was a very respected way of doing theology. It's since fallen out of favor, but it was very popular and very respected way of doing theology. And you'll see a lot of it showing up even in the Old Testament, particularly in Daniel.
Right.
Which is a bit of a midrash on contemporary history and on the Book of Enoch.
And there's a sort of midrash that or a watered down form of midrash that's practiced by Christians to this day. I'm thinking of Hal Lindsey, when he, you know, the late great Planet Earth, when he's making all these predictions about, you know, the signs that we'll see during the apocalypse, and he's taking these Old Testament verses and reworking them, and these grasshopper like things, well, these are actually Russian attack helicopters. You know, that's a sort of modern Christian midrash. That's exactly the type of thing that Paul may have been doing there.
Yeah, and there's actually a doctrine called the doctrine of dual prophetic fulfillment, that is held by dispensationalists.
Right.
That is explicitly midrashic. It says, right, these prophecies, which may already have been fulfilled, are also intended for us. Right. Therefore, they will apply in this way and this way.
Right. So a number of other aspects that Paul talks about that Jesus, the character of Jesus anyway, mentions in the Gospels, which it would be, it seems like it would be obvious for him to mention, but he does not. When Paul talks about the profanity of things in Romans 14, he says, nothing is profane in itself. That harkens back to Mark 7, when Jesus says nothing outside the man which is going into him can defile him. Seems like it would be an obvious callback there. Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 says, he talks about having enough faith to move mountains. And of course, we know in Matthew 17, Jesus said basically the same thing.
And I should point out that a lot of these, the way that the similarities play into the mythicist hypothesis, is that biblical scholarship dates even the earliest gospel as quite a bit after these letters of Paul. So from a mythicist perspective, one would expect that someone writing a gospel in the Pauline church would use those wisest bits from Paul, and would have understood them to come from the Lord, and
right,
would be looking for a historical context where they might have been plausible.
Right, because as Paul explains, whenever he gives these teachings, he explains that these come from the Lord. But when he says that, of course, he means direct revelation.
Visions, yeah.
Yeah, that the Jesus is speaking to him and telling him these things. So there's also, Paul talks about giving away all his possessions, just like Jesus does in Matthew 19. Paul uses the phrase that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, just like Jesus is saying in Matthew 24. He doesn't quote Jesus when he tells Christians to live at peace among themselves, like Jesus does in Mark 9. The famous judgment of Jesus about paying taxes, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Well, Paul doesn't mention that in Romans 13 when he says, you know, render tax to whom tax is due, custom to his custom. And this is another argument that would seem obvious, you know, well, look, you do this because this is what Jesus said. There are some other weird things. In Romans 8, actually 8:26, he says that the Spirit too comes to help us in our weakness, for when we do not know how to pray properly, the Spirit personally makes our petitions for us. But of course, Jesus gave instructions on how to pray in the Gospels, you know, the Lord's Prayer.
Lord's Prayer.
That this is how you should pray. Paul doesn't seem to know about that. There are a couple places where Paul actually contradicts or corrects Jesus, when he talks about marriage in 1 Corinthians 7, he says that a wife must not be separated from her husband, or if she has already left him, she must remain unmarried, blah, 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 and a husband must not divorce his wife. And, of course, in Matthew 19, Jesus said almost the same thing, although he said that in the case of adultery, it would be permissible to divorce, and Paul does not give this out. Also, 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says that the Lord gave instruction that those who preach the gospel should get their living by the gospel. In other words, they should be supported by whom they preach to. I don't think that's right English, but the people who receive them.
Basically, pastors should be supported by their congregations.
Right, right. And although in Matthew 10, Jesus says something similar. He's giving these instructions: provide yourself with no gold or silver, for the laborer deserves his keep. It seems like that would be an obvious callback there. And there's several others, but I'm gonna step back and let Dan talk a little bit more about these before I go on.
I don't know. I think we ought to pass this on to John. We've been hogging most of the time.
Yeah, I suppose so. So what's your take on this on Paul giving all these instructions and not sort of giving credit where credit would seem to be due?
Well, I've been looking at some of these as you've been talking through them.
Yeah.
And I think some of them, I'm not going to try to escape out some back door here. I'm really going to try to deal with these. But some of it seems like, you could look at what Paul was teaching, especially if, let's say the Lord did meet with him and give him particular instructions on things. I think it depends on how you look at the teaching. Is what Paul is doing a real linear thing? Is there something really linear going on here where it was Jesus telling the disciples and the disciples went and met with Paul, or Paul got it from them, or who, or whatever, and then Paul kind of carried it down and all that information was passed down nice and neat? Or like Paul says, he received, this from the Lord or whatever. Now, I think that phrase in itself is problematic. What does he mean he received it from the Lord? Could it be a tradition that he got from the disciples, and that's one of the things that he met with them about? Hey, what's going on? What are you guys doing in your churches? Because I think that we might be saying too much to say, Paul saying he received all of this information from the Lord. Well, no, in this passage it says he received all of this information from the disciples. And there's an obvious contradiction. Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you would be right, except for that pesky passage in Galatians where he goes to great lengths to specifically disclaim a doctrinal link with the Jerusalem church.
Yeah, first chapter.
He's very adamant about it.
Yeah, he says that he received his ministry from Jesus directly, and he didn't even go to check initially in Jerusalem to see if that all was correct for several years. He stayed away for several years. I think he went to Arabia and Syria, and it was only later he came and checked with things. And he doesn't say that he received extra instruction. All he says is that they listened to his gospel and they didn't add anything to it. So the implication there is that everything Paul preaches, even though it got the stamp of approval from the guys in Jerusalem, initially came from direct revelation itself. At least that's the implication.
Yeah, and I see that. In Galatians here, I almost said First Galatians, though. In Galatians 1:11, where he says, I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel.
Right.
Now, I don't know. I don't know if that means, he said, I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through revelation of Jesus Christ. Well, what all, I think that goes back, what all did he receive? What is it exactly? Was it like a condensed version? Was it something simple that he would be able to, Maybe he was preaching something from a different angle. Maybe it's kind of a fifth gospel type deal. Paul's teaching it one way because he's reaching a particular audience, a particular genre. Maybe he's highlighting some things, which is what some folks think the different writers of the gospels different statements of what Jesus said on the cross. And they're like, well, they're highlighting different aspects of Jesus. And I don't know if that's the case, but I think that I think there's a lot more digging to be done in this case, for just because looking at the even a cursory reading, and I know I'm biased, I'll go ahead and admit that, but I don't know if there's enough information really for there to be a real contradiction, because looking at timelines, what exactly was he talking about when he met with the disciples? And I mean, would we really assume that whoever wrote these would make that kind of mistake? I mean, because that's pretty glaring if you think about it, for someone to write, well, I did not get this, this did not come this way, and then, you know, however
well,
long.
I don't know about that. I think you're presupposing a social reality that didn't exist at the time. We're used to, someone sets up competition with us in a business, right? We know about it. We've got the internet. We've got high-speed communications. We've got high-speed travel. Paul is operating in Asia Minor, which is weeks' journey from Jerusalem. And the people who make that journey most often are not going to be church members. They're going to, because the church was comprised mostly of wealthy Roman matrons, slaves, and freedmen, who didn't get around a lot. The people who make that journey regularly are people who run trade routes. Most traders were either pagans or Jews, and there's going to be a little overlap. But even in the event of a serious disagreement, it's going to take years for the both parties to the disagreement to know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, hey, John, let me give you a couple minutes to give some final thoughts and get out of here, because it's almost 8 o'clock. I see we're just barely halfway through. I see. So you give us some final thoughts, and then Dan, if you want to stick around, and we'll just get the rest of these out there.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I guess in continuation of what I was saying, and I'm going to keep looking into this, and.
Sorry about interrupting you, by the way.
Oh no, it's cool. It's cool. I'd rather be stopped if I'm going to keep on a line that's not really going to go anywhere. I'd rather go ahead and cut that off. It seems that a lot of this is really complicated in terms of what Paul exactly means when he says a particular thing, what he was taught, what he received, how much did he receive. Why did he meet with the disciples? Could it have been something, hey, just checking, you guys have any other traditions I should know about? Is there, just kind of getting together and, hey, this is what I received from Jesus. And really that kind of thing. I mean, as odd as it may sound, when I reflect on it, it's almost commendable in the sense that it's kind of like, maybe he really did want to make sure. Maybe he, was thinking, maybe this could be, maybe I could be mistaken about something. Maybe I could do this. And I don't think that that's really saying too much when we consider the kind of thick-headedness we see with Peter. Yeah, I mean, assuming those accounts are true, I mean, certainly in, Jesus' ascension into heaven, where it says some doubted, like they're staring at Jesus floating up into the clouds going, dude, I don't know. I had a brother that used to be able to do that. And so I don't know. I mean, there's so much honest thick headedness going on with so many of these disciples where Jesus, I mean, he calls Peter Satan, and I don't think he was saying it's Peter being foolish. I really think he's making a particular statement regarding his mission, but a lot of it's pretty consistent. I mean, the disciples are just, they don't get it. And even as a believer now, there's some days, man, I wake up and I'm like, well, really? And so it's always good to go somewhere, even if it's the exact same message and I'm really confident, to go and meet with other people and say, okay, what do you believe? Oh, I believe this. Well, what do you think this passage means? Well, I think it means this, and here's what we're teaching. And when I go and tell people, you know, I don't say, well, look, I received this and I wasn't sure, but I went and talked to these guys, so this is what I received. I say, no, I was saved by Jesus himself, and this is my conviction about this, and might go check it with these other guys. Now, that may be a weak case regarding some of the stuff, and like I said, I'll look into it further, but it seems that there are a lot of nuances. It's a really complex issue in terms of what kind of information is being passed around, who is the audience, what has he already said. For example, in 1 Corinthians, we know that our 1 Corinthians is not the 1 Corinthians, it's just the 1 Corinthians we have. And what else did he teach them beforehand? What did he have to say? And I think also maybe some arguments might be assuming that Paul would want to do too much with his letters. I mean, to me, it would seem kind of odd if, you know, we're trekking through Galatians and Paul all of a sudden busts out with some discourse, you know, quoting five paragraphs from Mark. We'd be like, what the junk? What is he doing? You know, right. It would just seem out of place, especially if this is a church he set up. He's already appointed elders. He's known these people. He's lived with them and served them. And I mean, to be like, oh, and by the way, don't you remember that in John it reads blah, 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 blah. And honestly, I think that might be a little too convenient. And especially if taking, you know, certain things into consideration, like Paul continuing on a tradition, he's going to bring in some new aspects and new lights considering his audience. Mm.
I agree in principle, and I don't think any one particular one of these pieces of evidence is a linchpin. But taken as a preponderance, I think it creates a problem.
Right.
It's not reasonable to expect Paul to pedantically go back and refer to or quote Jesus every time he gets in a bind.
But the fact is that he doesn't do it any time.
Yeah, the fact is that he never does it. In all of his letters where he is very very explicit about quoting Old Testament scripture when it serves his purpose. Right. And it's that disconnect between the way he'll cite evidence from one source but not from another that raises the question, did Paul even believe that Jesus was a man who walked on the earth, or did he believe something else about him?
Right. Well, John, you got to get going or else Jamie's going to be coming after me.
Yeah. Hey, we had a great time, by the way.
Yeah, good.
That was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed that. We appreciate it. And we'll have to do it again.
Good thanks talking for with me. You again, John.
Oh, Dan, always a pleasure. And you got to come down soon.
Oh, boy.
All right, John.
All right, guys.
Talk to you later.
Have a good one.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, before we close out, Paul, actually, I do want to bring up there's really no time to get into any of this guy's arguments, but I do want to mention Donald Harmon Atkinson. I don't know if you've heard of this guy, Dan, but he's written I got into him because he wrote this really cool book called Surpassing Wonder about the composition.
I've heard of him, but I've never read him.
Yeah, it's a great book. I mean, really big and thick, comprehensive about the composition of the Torah, and the Talmuds, which is a really sort of paradigmatic shift in terms of how you think about the ancient Hebrews. But he also wrote a book called Saint Saul, and this is his foray into the historical Jesus quest. And his argument is that, well, you know, since we know that the writings of Paul, and he refers to him as Saul just to sort of as a rhetorical point to shake us up and make us sort of think differently.
It says here that he's also a Judaic scholar, so he's coming at it from more of a Jewish angle.
Yeah, and he's also a Judaic scholar and a scholar of Irish history, strangely enough.
Oh, nice.
And he's written a book on the Irish diaspora, which is really fascinating too. But in Saint Saul, he argues that, well, since the letters of Paul are the closest we can get to an historical Jesus, if one existed. And I'm not sure, it's kind of difficult. I mean, he certainly makes an argument for the existence of a historical Jesus. I'm not quite sure what his beliefs are. He keeps those reasonably well hidden. But his argument is that if there's any place we can find out anything about the historical Jesus, it's in the letters of Paul and figuring out how Paul understood Jesus. And of course, I would agree with him.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable hypothesis.
To a point, but he makes a lot of for example, all the things that that I just went over about all these parallels in between the teachings of Paul and the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, he argues that those are the derivative of the actual historical Jesus. And even though Paul doesn't cite them, he makes this argument. I think it's overreaching, but he makes the argument that Paul would have instructed his congregations personally in all the stuff that we find in the Gospels, but wouldn't have written it down in his letters. In his letters, he's assuming that
they'll know what he's talking about.
Know what he's talking about, and when he refers to a teaching of Jesus, that they know that he's citing Jesus, even though he doesn't make that explicit.
That's an odd middle way to go.
It's
almost trying to have it both ways, because Paul is referring to a quote by Jesus, and then the gospel writers are reconstructing that quote based on Paul.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very, very strange, but it's a fascinating book, and it really is kind of a weird little a different look at the whole thing. You know, for those of us that have been bogged down in like all the Jesus seminar stuff,
I'm looking at the Amazon page. It looks like it'd definitely be worth picking up.
Yeah. All right, well, so now we're going to set Paul to the side a little bit and move away from the Bible and look at some of the arguments from silence in non-biblical but contemporary sources, starting with Josephus. And the first basic argument here is that the Testimonium Flavianum, which is the work in Josephus's Antiquities, which mentions specifically Jesus the Christ, that this is actually a suspect interpolation, with the implication that Josephus, given that it's an interpolation, there's no other mention of Jesus in the Antiquities aside from this and something else, which is also a suspect interpolation. I'll go over both of those. So given that these are most probably interpolations, then Josephus was unaware of Jesus' ministry, and he was the official, unofficial historian of the Jews, specifically in first century Palestine. That was his specialty, and he was contemporary with the early church in that regard.
Yeah, Josephus, for listeners that don't know, was Justinian's pet? No, it wasn't Justinian.
Titus's
pet historian.
Right.
He was a leading Pharisaical scholar who turned coat during the siege of Jerusalem and sold out the city, allowing it to be leveled.
Right.
After it being leveled, he made a history of the Jewish people to commemorate what had been destroyed, and with an eye towards pleasing Caesar and trying to vindicate his people to protect them against further persecution.
Right. And in doing so, he actually, the thing that endeared him to Titus most of all was the fact that he proclaimed Titus to be the Jewish Messiah. Yep. Right. And so, who's not going to like that? Oh, you're the Messiah. Right. Oh, thank you very much. So he was the pet Jew at the court of Titus, and he got to spend his time sort of nursing his wounds and making up for the fact that he betrayed his countrymen,
right?
By trying to vindicate them in the historical record. But at any rate, as I mentioned in the Antiquities, he mentions the big one, that the Testimonium Flavianum, the Latin name for this thing. He was Flavius Josephus. He took the name of the family name of Titus.
Titus Flavius, the
Flavians. So it's the Testimonium Flavianum, and the main part of this is in Antiquities 18.
I have it in front of me. If you'd like me to.
Yeah,
read
go
it.
Ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. The entire thing is in 18, section 3.3.
Right.
It reads. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us had condemned him to the cross. Those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again on the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of the Christians, so named for him, are not extinct to this day.
Right. That's a pretty good testimony. I mean, you know, you gotta love that, and the Christians throughout the church history really have loved that. And this may the existence of this testimonium may actually be the reason why we have the works of Josephus so well preserved.
Yes.
Because the anybody who was going to disparage Jesus back then was not likely to have
their works copied.
Their works preserved. Yeah. There's aside from this, just before we start dissecting Antiquities 18, in Antiquities 9, there's another account which is a really sort of complex explanation of a political situation involving the high priest Ananias, I think his name was. Yeah, Ananias. And he
– Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry. It's Ananias.
Ananias. And he assembled the Sanhedrin, and it says that he brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, whose name was James, and some others, and he had them stoned. And so, of course, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, whose name was James. Well, you know, that harkens right back to the Gospels. The problem is, just like you find with in the proper testimonium in 18, you find this "who was called Christ." That is extremely problematic a phrase for Josephus to write down, because, of course, Josephus was a Jew. And did
who
not
worship Flavius.
Right. He certainly did not recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And he had publicly declared Titus to be the Messiah. So, the fact that he refers to Jesus, or the fact that the text refers to Jesus as the Christ, just cannot come from Josephus.
And it's worth pointing out that the reference to Jesus, the brother of James here, first of all, we don't get James, the brother of Jesus, from the Gospels. The character never appears.
Right.
We get James, the brother of the Lord, from Paul.
Paul,
and
there's
an argument that's been going on for hundreds of years over whether that means brother like we had the same mother or brother like we shared fellowship.
Right, just like Christians use to this day. Oh, you know, brother Joe, come over here and let's pray together. You know, they use this same type of terminology.
Right.
So it is not surprising at all.
Yeah, but even granting that the sibling thing might be how they understood it, the fact is that the passage occurs in a context. Both passages actually occur in contexts around which there are laundry lists of Jesuses.
Right.
Different people who took on the name Jesus as a way to proclaim their intention to be rebels, to liken themselves to Joshua, who was seen as the great, as the first great Messiah.
Right. And in fact, in Antiquities 9, right after it mentions James, the brother of Jesus, the Christ, as I said, the high priest had him stoned to death, which of course contradicts the account in Acts, but the Jews, this is also somewhat surprising if it's the James from the Bible. The Jews were upset about this, and they demanded that Ananias should be deposed. This is kind of strange if James was who Paul or the Gospels or Christians nowadays anyway think he was. He was a radical Jewish, apostate. You know, he wasn't an Orthodox Jew by any sense of the word. Mm-hmm. So it seems quite strange for the leading Jews, the Sanhedrin, to be upset by the fact that this this apostate, this rebel, this heretic was killed. But at any rate,
At the end of the passage, it notes that as a result of the stoning of James and the deposing of Ananias, God, that name gives me trouble. They went and made Jesus, son of Damnius, the high priest.
Right. So there's another Jesus.
Now, well, the context, if you take out who was called the Christ out of that whole thing, it very strongly implies that Damnaeus was also the father of James, and that the Jesus who acceded to the head of the Sanhedrin did so because his brother was unjustly murdered and he was receiving his brother's rightful place in accordance with old style Jewish law.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely a possibility there. So that pretty much takes care of Antiquities 9, the brother of Jesus passage. Aside from just the fact that in Antiquities 18, Josephus calls Jesus the Christ, and of course we should immediately discount that as problematic. There's other things that are sort of weird about it too. The phrase the tribe of Christian, so named for him, that seems to be dependent on the fact that the phrase preceding it is he was the Christ. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make much sense to talk about Christians being so named for him if you don't mention that he was the Christ at some point previously to that. So that can probably be discounted.
The rest of the thing, barely two words go by where he's not exalting this man.
Right.
And essentially it's a liturgical statement, the whole thing, which brings it, considering who Josephus was, it makes it all very suspect.
Right. It's completely out of character, because every other Messiah that he talks about, all these other would-be Messiahs that existed in Palestine at that time, he's got nothing but unkind things to say. And yet for this guy, you know, he's just nothing but glowing words.
Yeah. And it also contradicts the gospel at the point when it says that his followers loved him and did not at first forsake him. The Gospels, of course, tell exactly the opposite story.
Yeah.
So at the very least, that points to a varying tradition about what the disciples did after Jesus was betrayed.
Right.
Doesn't by itself call. In fact, actually, that's the one part of the testimonium I think is a point in its favor, is that it's a variant tradition.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, just getting back to the paradigm that we're talking about arguments from silence. Another thing against the veracity of the testimonium is the fact that we don't find any mention of the testimonium in any of the earliest Christian fathers. I'm talking about Origen, Justin Martyr, Theophilus, and Tychicus,
Irenaeus,
Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Julius Africanus. None of these guys mention the testimonium. Although
it actually goes a step further. Origen, particularly, who was fond of quoting hell out of people,
he loved,
and in
Josephus,
fact, quoted almost Josephus's entire surviving works.
Right.
In his works, came right out and said that if Josephus knew of Jesus, he never talked about it.
Right.
So we have testimony from the year 240 that there was no testimonium in Josephus's works.
Right. And that's a pretty damning argument from silence right there. The other sort of other bookend to this is that the time in history when the testimonium first sort of appears is after the time of
Eusebius,
the bishop of Caesarea, who is somewhat infamous for suggesting that pious falsehoods were justifiable.
He was Constantine's pet historian.
Right, right.
Eusebius's what was Eusebius's major work? He attempted to write a complete history of Christianity.
Yeah, right.
It still survives. You can get it online in various translations.
Right, but he takes all kinds of liberties with yes. Philo. He has him doing all sorts of weird things that we know Philo didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
To try to.
Yeah. He's what was it Richard Carrier says about Eusebius? He says, regrettably, he is our only source.
Yeah. For a lot of things, yeah.
Yeah, so we have to treat him with great suspicion, but we can't ignore him entirely because we don't have any other link back to a lot of the things he covers.
Yeah.
But there are a number The first place the testimonium ever appears is in Eusebius's work.
Yeah.
So there's a great circumstantial case that Eusebius actually forged the thing himself.
Right.
I can't remember who it was. It was one of the reformers in the 15th century. I think it was Luther, but I'm forgetting the reference right now. But one of the reformers spoke of having seen a surviving copy of the testimony of Josephus without the testimony.
Yeah, although that hasn't been tracked down, unfortunately.
Okay.
So I don't think it's been tracked down anyway.
Yeah. I'm sorry, am I stealing all your thunder here?
No, go ahead.
The two points in, or the one last point in favor of at least some sort of basic version of the testimony being authentic, is what's called the argument from partial authenticity, where the idea was there was an original actual reference to Jesus that was then embellished. Mm. Is that there are two other surviving versions of this, which are far more elaborate, in the Arabic version and the Syriac version of Josephus.
I thought it was the Slavonic.
Slavonic. And the problem with this is, of course, that we don't have surviving manuscripts that are older than Eusebius, so right. We can't confidently say one way or the other that they were there before, or that they were embellishments of the embellishments, etc.
And although it's tempting to point at the Arabic version and say, well, see, even the Arabs kept it. Well, they, mm-hmm. In Islam, Jesus is an important character, a historical character, and so they have as much reason to want to keep him in there as anybody else. Certainly, mm-hmm. as much as the Christians. There's actually, I think it's Joseph Hoffman, points out that the language that's used to describe Jesus is very similar to the language that was used previously in the antiquities to describe John the Baptist.
Yes.
Which, of course, suggests that the former may have been derived from the latter. Whoever did this just took the basic structure of the John the Baptist description and just remade it as Jesus's. And yeah. I've also heard the argument that the linguistic characteristics match more with the style of Eusebius than they do with Josephus. Yes. Although I really can't evaluate that for myself. Yeah.
I'm not good enough with Greek that way, but there is one other significant literary point against the authenticity of the testimonium. And that's that it's dropped right in between two sections that flow together as a single narrative. Yeah. If you remove the whole chunk.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I believe Richard Carrier recently mentioned that he is working on, as soon as his PhD is finished, he'll be working on publishing an argument that shows that the interpolations actually stem inadvertently from Origen. That Origen, what he believes is the best explanation for this is that Origen would have written these things down in his copy in the margins for his own benefit. And that because they came, from him, they were later copies of the work would have included them.
And for Christians listening to this, that hypothesis is not incompatible with believing in biblical authority. The Bible that you have in your hands is a Bible that's been arrived at by comparing hundreds and thousands of Greek manuscripts from different eras of different provenances, some known and some unknown. No two of which are alike. The idea is that this is the discipline called textual criticism. The idea is that by comparing the different variants, taking into consideration where they came from, what branch of the church, etc., what variants are likely to be interpolated to serve a particular doctrine, they weed out by comparison passages that are definitely spurious, passages that are probably spurious. And if you look in the footnotes of your Bible, you'll start to see, particularly in the Gospels, but also throughout, notes on some manuscripts say this alternate thing here, this alternate thing that's doctrinally significant sometimes.
Yeah.
And the probably the most obvious example of this is the long ending of Mark.
Right.
The everything that takes place after the burial of Christ in Mark didn't exist in the early manuscripts. It was added at least 100 years later, and probably a little longer later than that, to bring it into conformity with the other gospels.
Yeah. And this is what you call the orthodox corruption of Scripture. This is Bart Ehrman has written a seminal work on this. A much more approachable version of this argument is found in Misquoting Jesus, his other book. And we'll actually get into this a little bit more, I think, in the section on biblical ahistoricity.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that although I find the very fact that this has gone on to be a point against the authority of the Bible, and a lot of free thinkers do, and Bart Ehrman certainly does.
Yeah.
The Biblical Studies Department at Dallas Theological Seminary, one of the most conservative seminaries in the world, has a textual criticism department, and Dan Wallace, the head of that department, is one of the world's best textual critics who has no problem reconciling one with the other.
Yeah, that's a very good point. All right, well, moving away from Josephus, now let's wrap this up by looking at other contemporary historians, pagan historians. These are also people that are outside. Josephus was a Jew, so he was somewhat tangentially related to the.
Let's clarify what we mean by contemporary, though. Josephus is the earliest one of these, and he's writing 65 years after Jesus is said to have died.
Well, that's true. Although we do have Philo of Alexandria, who was.
Philo actually precedes Jesus by quite a while.
Precedes him by, well, he lived from, what was it, 25 BCE to about 50. So he's
So he's kind of a contemporary, but he wasn't a historian.
Well, he wasn't a historian, but he was a prolific writer, especially about contemporary events.
Okay.
Especially the political goings on in Palestine. And he was actually connected. He was connected by marriage. I think his nephew was part of, had married into the royal house somehow of Herod Agrippa's family. I can't remember exactly what the relationship is, but he was an aristocratic Jew living in Alexandria. But he did spend a bit of time in Jerusalem, and he wrote a lot about Judaism.
He was in fact the foremost philosopher of Gnostic Judaism.
Right, and he was somewhat famous for arguing that the Greek philosophers got all their knowledge from sort of reinterpreting the words of Moses in the Pentateuch. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just bring him up to say that this was a guy who was living. He was living at the time when Jesus is supposed to have been living during the time of the crucifixion, was aware, well-connected guy, well-connected to the political situation in Palestine. If anybody was in a position to comment on the goings on, and if any weird things had come up of the type of import that we see in the Gospels, it would have been Philo. But he does not mention anything about Jesus. He does not mention anything about Christians, although he died a little bit early for, I mean, he died somewhat, just, I think a little bit before Paul got popular. So yeah. he ended his career right on the cusp of the beginning of the Jewish church, but he would have been in a position to know anything, to know something about the historical Jesus. But he
didn't. It's also worth pointing out that Philo had more influence on the development of Christianity than any other single person, than except perhaps Paul.
Yeah, that there's a pretty good argument for that too, and we'll probably get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
So the other guys that I want to bring up, and as you said, yeah, they're not technically contemporary, but they're about as close as we can get in terms of pagan historians to the events that transpired. Unfortunately, Josephus, you've got Philo sort of at the beginning of the first century. Josephus takes it like in the middle towards the end. And then right at the beginning of the second century, we get a bunch of other guys cropping up. And the first one is Pliny the Younger. And Pliny was also a really well-connected guy, really intelligent, and he was governor of the province Bithynia, which is in Asia. I think it's to the
north. Asia Minor, right?
Asia Minor. It's to the north of it's to the north of Galatia, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so.
Up in modern-day Turkey.
Right. And so he was governor there from about 111 to 113. And, of course, we know Asia Minor was a hotbed of Christianity. I mean, that's where Paul spent a great deal of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And Pliny actually ran into some Christians and in the matter of his official duties as governor. And it was a problem for him. And it's kind of complicated to explain why it was a problem for him. It wasn't the situation at the time was not that the Romans wanted to prevent Christians from being Christians per se, simply because they didn't like their religion. The problem was that Christians refused to acknowledge the deity of the emperor. So it was not so much of a persecution of someone's religious beliefs as much as it was, you know, these guys are refusing to acknowledge our political authority. And part of that political authority was the fact that the emperor was considered to be a god. And so you have to acknowledge the emperor as a god in order to be a part of this political structure. And the Christians refused to do that. And so that's why it was problematic for
right. Particularly with the Christians claiming descent from the Jews, who were already such a problem.
Right, right. That certainly didn't help them. So Pliny gets a bunch of Christians sort of making some trouble in his province, and he writes actually to the emperor, to Trajan, and Trajan wrote him back, and we have these letters, and Pliny basically says, you know, I really don't know anything about these Christians. I've never participated in any trials of Christians. You know, he doesn't really know what the best thing is to do, and that's why he's writing this letter. And he says that he had a number of people that were denounced to him as Christians. And so that, I mean, again, for him as governor, these are people that are being denounced as traitors, as, you know, not loyal to the imperial throne. And so he, you know, he did what he thought was right. He interrogated them. He said, are you really a Christian? Yeah, okay. Well, if you are, you know, you can't be part of this society, and so you're going to be executed, right? So he executed a bunch of Christians. And again, this was not because he didn't like their beliefs. This is just because they were perceived as being disloyal to the emperor, which the Romans would not tolerate. Mm-hmm. And then following this, he had it was kind of like the communist scare in America, that he got this list of names of, oh, well, there's all these other Christians that we want you to deal with, too, because it was known that he was executing Christians. And so it seemed like it was getting out of hand to him. And he's like, I don't know exactly what I want to do here. So he, you know, he brought some people in that were named as Christians. And he said, well, you know, are you a Christian? And some of them said yes. Some of them said no. And, you know, the way that they proved that they were not Christians is that they were, they would pray to the emperor, to the image of the emperor, and curse Christ. And so by this way, they disproved the fact that they were Christians. Yeah. And he was still not quite, you know.
He basically lost his stomach for the affair.
Yeah, he was not.
And he was.
Yeah.
He was writing to Trajan basically for permission to leave these people alone.
Right. Yeah. And he wasn't. At the end of all these interrogations, he was like, yeah, I don't quite know if I get what the big deal is here. And he says that he took a couple of the women Christians, female slaves, actually, that were referred to him as deaconesses. So these were female slaves that were leaders of the Christian church, sort of from modern Christians, for certain denominations that can be problematic.
Scandalous.
Yeah. But, you know, he says he actually tortured them. You know, he's like, I really want to know what these people actually believe, because he wanted to know if these were traitors. You know, these are people that he should be worried about, because I don't think he really, like you said, he lost his stomach for executing these people. And he said, you know, when he tortured these women and, you know, found out what they actually believed, he said he There is nothing but depraved, excessive superstition. So nothing to be worried about, basically. And so he says he discontinued his interrogations and wrote to Trajan and said, you know, what should I do? And Trajan says, you know, well, you did the right thing. You know, if there's anybody, you know, look, if there are people that will not bow down to me, will not acknowledge my power, then yeah, you got to execute them. You know, that's just the way it is. So what's interesting about this is that we have this account of Christians and this is in the early second century,
about 105, I believe it was.
Yeah. And but we don't really know anything about what they actually believed. The ones that the Christians that he interrogated, that he inquired as to, you know, what the hell do you guys do? They say that, you know, well, they meet, they don't do anything bad. All they do is they meet one day a week before dawn, and they sing songs to Christ as to a god, and they bind themselves by oath to not commit fraud, to not commit theft or adultery, basically to be good people, right? So they mm-hmm. get together, they sing to Christ, and they tell each other to be good people, and then after that, they just get together and eat a meal together. You know, so this is the earliest glimpse into, you know, what the practices were of
churchgoers.
And it, you know, it seemed like, you know, honestly, and we're going to get into this a little bit later, but it seems like any average mystery cult, you know, just getting together, mm-hmm. and it's almost like there's a misunderstanding, like it's a sitcom gone horribly awry,
right?
And you know, they're saying, yeah,
the salient point, because we're just going on and on about this because it's interesting,
yeah,
but the salient point is that in these letters of Pliny and Trajan, there isn't a single thing that Pliny doesn't claim to have heard from the Christians themselves.
Right.
And we're talking Christians 65, 70 years after Jesus was said to have died.
Right.
So no one, not even the most hardcore mythicist, disputes the existence of Christianity.
Of a Christian church. Yeah.
Of a Christian church in Asia Minor, even after the year 50. So this is a lot of evidence for something we knew already and doesn't actually bear directly on the question of whether there was ever a Jesus or not.
Right. But it's important to note that Pliny, I mean, as well-educated and well-connected of a guy as he was, had no idea about any of this Christian. Never heard of Jesus, never heard of any of these goings on. I mean, you know, it was...
Doesn't mention that thing that Pilate did that pissed everyone off.
It was so foreign to him, he actually had to bring people in and torture them to get the story straight. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's somewhat odd in terms of, you know, the fact that it was so foreign to him that he had no idea. The next guy is Tacitus, and Tacitus was actually Richard Carrier makes the argument that his mention in his annals it was probably secondary to Pliny, because these guys were really good friends, and in fact they were governors at the same time in neighboring provinces, and this was, you know, when Pliny learned about the Christians, Tacitus is basically next door. It's not too hard to imagine that Tacitus probably learned what he learned from Pliny. At any event, in his annals, where he's criticizing Nero, he makes mention of the fact that after the Roman fire, Nero had tried to pass the guilt, because a lot of people suspected that Nero himself had started the fire, but Nero tried to blame the Christians living in Rome, and Tacitus says that Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Not exactly a glowing endorsement of either Christianity or Rome. But it's, again, there's nothing here that was not being promoted by Christians at the time. So right. there's no first.
You have to put yourself into the headspace of an aristocratic Roman who is writing to slag off a previous emperor.
Right. Because he did not like Nero.
Yeah, and this is not a man. The rest of his writings make it very clear that he thinks less of Judea and its inhabitants and its religions than he does of what he leaves in the toilet every morning. Mm. This is not a man who would go out and do field research or even bother to check colonial historical documents, which in those times would have required quite a trek. He's gonna pick up on what the people are saying about themselves or what's generally known about them, kind of like you and I know that Mormons believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet.
Right.
You know, you and I can know that without ever reading the Book of Mormon, without ever right. going to a Mormon service.
Exactly.
And we can certainly know that without ever having to travel into Missouri
Salt Lake City
yeah. and look up the historical registry to make sure Joseph Smith existed. We don't care about that. We just know that the Mormons believe in him. And when we're talking about Mormons, that's all we need to know.
Yeah. So that's Tacitus, and that's Pliny and Tacitus, really. I mean, in terms of pagan historians, they're our most fruitful source in terms of, I mean, this is pretty much it. There are two other guys, Suetonius,
yes.
Yeah, and who only mentions
Christians. He doesn't even talk about what they believe.
Right, right. He wrote a number of biographies of the Caesars, and the one that he wrote about Claudius, he makes mention of the fact he's talking about many of the things that Claudius did to various groups of people within Rome when he was emperor. And he says that since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, that's Chrestus, mm-hmm. That Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome.
Right. And which might or might not be a reference to Christianity.
Right. It's hard to tell. I've heard some mention that Crestus can be translated into a completely different thing from Christ or Christus, which Tacitus uses. It tells us basically nothing. It implies that there's somebody named Crestus that's living at the time of Claudius in Rome, which is completely inconsistent with
right.
anything.
And, yeah, to be clear, Jesus is said to have been executed during the reign of Tiberius,
right? So it's the wrong time period.
Right.
It's the wrong.
Who was Claudius's predecessor by two emperors?
Right. So this is
Tiberius, then Caligula, then Claudius.
Right. Right. So historically, the account of Suetonius is absolutely worthless. I mean, on the one hand, we don't even know if it really is referring to Christ. On the other hand, even if it was, it's completely in the wrong historical context.
And tells us nothing even.
Really tells us nothing. And the only other one that I know of is the guy that's quoted by Julius Africanus, the Christian historian. Julius Africanus quotes a guy, Thallus, who was a pagan historian, I think, when Africanus is talking about the darkness that accompanied the death of Jesus. He makes mention of Thallus pointing out a darkness as an eclipse of the sun in his book, The Histories. And then he makes the argument that, well, of course, this had to have been
the darkness
that happened from the sixth hour to the ninth, blah, blah, blah. So it has to be the eclipse, or it has to be the darkness that's associated with Jesus. And this is really a stretch.
Well, there's a few problems with it. On the face of it, no eclipse lasts 3 hours.
Right.
a total eclipse of the sun lasts something like 15 minutes.
Right.
They're very brief events. And a total eclipse in one part of the world doesn't look like a total eclipse anywhere else outside maybe 30, 40 miles from where you're standing.
Right.
That plus the fact that he doesn't tie it down to a year, and the Gospels themselves aren't even clear about what year Jesus dies in.
Yeah.
He died anywhere from the year 26 to the year 32, and there's no way to pin it down close than that.
Yeah. And Richard Carrier on infidels.org has an article about this, actually, where he goes all the way through this in typical Richard Carrier fashion and just absolutely puts this to bed. Completely disproves this this argument from Fallas. So that's all the pagan historians that I know of. Have I pretty much covered them all?
Yeah, you've covered them all. Okay. There's the typical Orthodox response to this is that the Gospels by themselves should be considered sufficient historical evidence because the events they describe are of such a small scale that we would expect them to escape the notice of contemporary secular historians. And yeah, that argument is okay insofar as it goes until we get to what we're going to cover next week, which is the argument from biblical ahistoricity, where it's very easy to demonstrate from within the text of the Bible itself that the Gospels are not intended to be read historically.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that about covers the arguments from silence about as well as we can manage here on Apologia. Although I think it's a valiant effort nonetheless.
Yeah.
This collection of arguments, although I find them particularly compelling, are, as I implied earlier, the weakest of the group.
Yes.
And this is, it's absolutely going to get better from here. Of course, if you've been bowled over with these, tighten your seatbelt for the next one.
Yeah, I ought to make it clear. I consider these supporting evidence at best.
Right. But they do provide a foundation that we'll be building on later. And so we'll pick up next time with the arguments from similarity. And thanks, gentlemen, for your contributions today. And we'll see you next time on Apologia.
So let me just pop in this A-track.